House Republicans push the Trump administration's message.
These folks are bound and determined to go after this president no matter what.
The president did nothing in this phone call that's impeachable.
How's an inquiry affect the president's campaign?
I'm Noel King here with Steve Inskeep, and this is Up First from NPR News. Joe Biden may not be the only rival on the minds of the Trump administration. The Washington Post reports the State Department is still investigating Hillary Clinton's emails. Why do some targets of that probe think it's politically motivated?
Also, Hong Kong witnesses one of its most violent weekends of protests. Police fired rubber bullets, tear gas, and water cannons. What makes this week especially sensitive? Stay with us. We'll guide you through this day's news.
Support for Up First and the following message come from Capital One, reimagining banking. They offer fee-free accounts that can be opened from anywhere in 5 minutes. That's less time than it takes to listen to Up First. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Capital One N.A. Support also comes from LinkedIn Job Seeker. Knowing where to look is the first step to finding the right job. LinkedIn's got 20 million jobs and people who can help you find them. Find the job meant for you at linkedin.com/jobs.
President Trump spent much of the weekend on Twitter. Tweets from the president's account denounced his critics or shared videos of his supporters more than 80 times.
Yeah, the president was sending messages as Democrats prepare hearings for an impeachment inquiry. House leaders have indicated that they want this examination to move fairly quickly. It would focus on the president's call to Ukraine asking for an investigation of his political opponent, Joe Biden. Yesterday, Adam Schiff, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, was asked on ABC how soon he might hear from the whistleblower who revealed the call. And here's what he said.
Very soon. It will depend probably more on how quickly the Director of National Intelligence can complete the security clearance process for the whistleblower's lawyers. But we're ready to hear from the whistleblower as soon as that is done.
NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith is with us this morning. Tam, good morning.
Good morning.
How serious is this challenge to the president?
It's serious. Democrats are taking this investigation very seriously in the House. Now, of course, he still has a Republican-controlled Senate, and that means that even if the House were to impeach the president, at this point, it seems quite unlikely that he would be removed by the Senate. But there are cracks. Tom Bossert, who's a former Homeland Security advisor to the president, said on ABC this weekend that he was deeply disturbed by what President Trump said on the call with the president of Ukraine. And that's notable because Bossert isn't a random guy. He worked closely with the president in the White House, though he also argued that on its own, the call wasn't impeachable. And that's what I'm hearing from multiple people close to the White House, is that they actually consider the call improper, but not impeachable.
Oh, which is different from what the president has repeatedly said when he has called the call a perfect phone conversation. How is the president defending himself?
Well, in one of the many tweets you mentioned, he accused a member of Congress of treason and said he wanted access to the whistleblower. Another one quoted someone as saying impeachment would lead to civil war. These are extreme, even by the standards of President Trump, and also way outside of the norms of past presidential conduct. During the last impeachment in 1998, the Clinton White House had a war room. People focused on fighting impeachment so that the rest could stay focused on policy. Out in the White House driveway on Friday, Kellyanne Conway was asked about whether the Trump White House would be setting up a war room.
Why would he do that? Who started the war here? He's the most battle-tested person I've ever met. Why do we need an impeachment war room when the other people have the burden of showing why they're impeaching the president?
In terms of communications, at least, the White House is pretty sparsely staffed right now, even compared to earlier in the Trump administration, much less other administrations, and much less a White House that is now facing an existential crisis.
Nevertheless, we clearly have the White House focused on this, if the 80 tweets from the president's personal account are any indication. But who will be backing up the president to defend him?
A really big part of this is going to be the campaign. No president has faced impeachment while also running for re-election. And what that means is that there already is a war room. There is literally a Twitter account called the Trump War Room, set up by the Trump campaign. There's a surrogate operation, rapid response research. That's all there. And over the weekend, the Trump campaign began a $10 million ad buy.
Okay. Tamara, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
There'll be so much more to say about this. That's NPR's Tamara Keith. The U.S. State Department is still investigating Hillary Clinton's emails.
This very toxic issue overshadowed the 2016 presidential election. So as a reminder, the FBI started looking at the former Secretary of State's use of a private email server back in 2015. A year later, James Comey, who was then the director of the FBI, announced that the case should be closed with no charges. But now the Washington Post is reporting that the matter isn't dead. The Trump administration is said to be investigating dozens of current and former State Department officials for what they sent to Secretary Clinton, and that some of their emails have even been retroactively classified.
The Washington Post's Greg Jaffe is among the team of reporters who broke this story. He's on the line. Greg, good morning.
Good morning.
How widespread is this investigation?
You know, it's about 130 or 140 people, and it hits people kind of at all levels of the State Department, from, you know, relatively senior or very senior positions like assistant secretaries of state down to anyone who might have passed emails that landed in Hillary Clinton's private email.
I'm trying to make sure I understand the essence of the question here. The question is basically asking various current and former diplomats, why did you send information to Hillary Clinton's private email server?
What happens is they find the emails on the server. They've gone through these kind of millions of emails and determined that a certain number contained classified information. And then they go back and ask people, why did you send this improperly classified email to Hillary Clinton? In virtually all the cases, they're retroactively classified. So they're people passing information they thought was unclassified that's later determined to be classified.
Retroactively classified. How much trouble can you be in for sending retroactively classified information, information you could not possibly have known was classified at the time?
Yeah, and I think there's valid debate about whether it should even be classified today. I think people were worried that it could impact their future. Most of these people are out of government, and that it could make it harder if they come back in government to get a security clearance. That's the essence of their worry.
Greg, do you have any sense, either from the investigators or those being investigated, as to what would be driving the State Department to look so closely into this matter years later?
You know, it's really hard to say. I don't have a great sense. They'll say that they're just doing business as usual, that this is an investigation that dates back to the end of the Obama administration, and they're just completing it now. But as to why they're doing it now, I think, you know, their argument is that they're doing their duty, that there was classified information found in Hillary Clinton's email, and they need to investigate it. I think others feel like this is sort of a form of low-level harassment.
Well, that's my question. Do the people being investigated think that they're targets of some kind of political attack?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think they feel like, you know, it's an effort to harass them, an effort to put things in their file that in the future could make it significantly harder for them to get a security clearance.
So nobody's going to be prosecuted for this, probably, but it would go on their permanent record, so to speak.
It could, yes, it could go on their permanent record. And most of the people have gotten letters saying that, you know, the security incidents in which they're involved are valid, but they're not culpable. That's if they cooperated. If they didn't cooperate, it gets a little bit more complicated.
Greg, thanks for your reporting.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Greg Jaffe of The Washington Post, and he spoke with us on Skype. Okay, this is what the 17th week of pro-democracy demonstrations sounded like in Hong Kong. We will hear the protesters confronting police now.
Yesterday, tear gas rose over major government and shopping areas. People threw bricks at the police, and authorities hit the crowds with water cannons. Now, these demonstrations come at a really important time, just before China's National Day. That is the 70th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China.
NPR's Julie McCarthy is in Hong Kong. Hi there, Julie.
Hi, Steve.
How did the protests unfold over the weekend?
Well, Sunday's big event was billed as a march against global totalitarianism. 60 other cities had marches like this, but here the demonstrators brandished banners about China that read evil dictatorship, and they chanted slogans certain to irritate Beijing.
Free Hong Kong!
Free Hong Kong!
Democracy now!
Democracy now!
Fight for freedom!
And the day was more violent than usual. Demonstrators set scores of street fires, volleys of tear gas and rubber bullets chased them from one street to the next. This went on for hours, and residents came down from their apartments in their slippers to see what the action was all about, some hurling insults at the police. We found a young student from France huddled in an alcove, crying, and had to escort her back to her hotel. It was that kind of a day.
Wow. Now, what is the significance of the timing here, that anniversary that Noel mentioned?
All of this, this tense weekend, comes right on the heels or is leading up to this big day in China. And here, there is deep antagonism toward mainland China over what they say, over what Hong Kong says, is Beijing not living up to an agreement that was supposed to preserve Hong Kong's freedoms for 50 years. Instead, they see Beijing creeping into their everyday lives, requiring a kind of fealty to China. And when I ask protesters, you know, what does the 70th anniversary of the founding of the PRC mean to you? To a person, Steve, they said, nothing. 24-year-old Origa Wong elaborated on that.
We lack the sense of belonging to China. We inherited a system different from China. So regarding the 70th anniversary, we don't have a special feeling.
No special feeling. They inherited a British system. And Wong says, look, Hong Kong has this core values that rely on democracy and rule of law and liberty. And these are liberties that no city in mainland China enjoys. Hong Kongers know it, and they're jealously guarding these freedoms. They don't want them eroded. And that is what these protests are about.
I'm just thinking, though, this 70th anniversary is a huge deal for mainland China. And here it comes. So how are protesters likely to mark?
Well, they're going to mark it really with counter commemorations. The court this afternoon denied the umbrella human rights group, the Civil Front, a police permit to march, but that doesn't stop protesters here. The fireworks over the harbor were canceled, and the flag-raising ceremony has been moved indoors to, quote, ensure it can be held in an orderly, solemn manner. But I don't expect much will be orderly or solemn in Hong Kong tomorrow.
Julie, thanks very much for the update.
Thank you.
NPR's Julie McCarthy is in Hong Kong. And that's Up First for this Monday, September 30th. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noel King. We would love it if you start your day here with us again tomorrow. And we get that the news doesn't stop when this podcast ends. So you could follow us on Twitter at Up First for a daily roundup of the most important stories of the day.
Thanks for listening to Up First. You can find more on the stories we discussed today on NPR's Morning Edition, the radio show that Noel and I host with Rachel Martin and David Green. You can find it on your NPR station and find the station at stations.npr.org.
Hey, Asma, I think it's time for a big change.
All right, what does that mean?
I think it's time to make the NPR Politics Podcast a daily podcast.
Well, we do have more than ample news. You and I are on the campaign trail, it seems like, nonstop.
And now there's an impeachment inquiry into President Trump.
So starting this week, the NPR Politics Podcast will be in your feed every weekday to keep you up to date ahead of the 2020 election.
So subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. The NPR Politics Podcast, now 5 days a week.